Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
This week we welcome space expert Rod Pyle talking about Sandra Bullock's amazing movie Gravity. He tells us what is accurate and where the movie takes creative license about what goes on in space. Social media expert Patrick Charles talks about the 80-20 rule and how that applies to the music industry. Donna Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we chat with Bob and Linda Carey about their successful tutu project that often brings comfort and joy to women dealing with breast cancer. We wrap things up chatting with Canadian singer-songwriter Lydia Hall and her song, This Fire.
Capture your need for sound.
A lot of people are talking about the Sandra Bullock and George Clooney movie, Gravity. There's amazing scenes and imagery from space, but is most of this movie accurate or does it take a lot of creative license? We're going to find out by talking to Rod Pyle. He's a writer, producer, and director, and notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, Rod, first of all, I have to ask you, did you like the movie? Because being a space expert, you would probably be more critical or be able to be more critical than the rest of us.
I love the movie, and I have to stand down for a moment because there's been a couple of interviews with shuttle astronauts who've actually been there, and they love the movie. So even if I didn't, I'd say I did. But, you know, I really did enjoy it. It was one of those, I think it's been widely remarked on. It's one of the landmark films, like 2001 Space Odyssey was, in the sort of real side of space, and an adventure like Aliens was, you know, these sort of landmark movies we think of in those genres. And even James Cameron said he thought it was one of the best he'd seen. And it was a great romp, and they tried really hard and they got most of it right. There's one big moment where if you had fifth grade science class, you go, no. And then there's a few other things that have been talked about some, but we'll get into that. But overall, I think it was great.
So I do want to get to the big faux pas, if you will, but what are the movie strengths, I guess, when it comes to showcasing space and being away from our planet?
They were very careful in getting the physics right overall. You know, EVA, extravehicular activity, when you're working outside the spacecraft, the space station, is really hard. And when they started doing that in the 60s, it took five or six flights in the Gemini series to actually figure out how to even get out and do anything other than wear yourself out and get winded. In fact, it was so dangerous, a couple of guys almost got in trouble because they were too tired to get back in the spacecraft. So they made that look pretty easy. But on the other hand, whenever something did go wrong and it wasn't a planned maneuver, they'd go banging around and fly all over the place and go out to the end of their tether and get lurched back. So that part I thought was handled really well. The physics of that, you know, the rebound of the reactions and so forth were handled really well. And the hardware was spectacular. You know, when Tom Hanks did Apollo 13, which is another watershed movie about space, he set the bar really high because he's a true believer in the space program of all nations, but especially the Apollo years in the U.S. So that stuff was dead accurate to the point that he filmed his weightless scenes mostly by doing parabolic flights in a plane that actually made it weightless. They didn't do that in Gravity. But they did make sure that the hardware was spot on. And so for somebody who's looked at that stuff for hours because I'm a space geek, you know, I knew that the buttons were in the right places and the stuff looked like it should. So that was a lot of fun because usually there's a groaner moment where you go, yeah, you know, they don't fly that with the joystick anymore. That kind of went out with the Mercury series. So it was nice to see them really make sure they got it right.
And how about representing NASA and astronauts in general? Like, did they stay sort of true to what is or what was?
More or less. You know, they took it out to two extremes. On George Clooney's side, he's a hot dog. He's obviously a former test pilot. You know, he's an ace. And so he's got this little rocket pack on his back that they used to call the MMU, the Manned Maneuvering Unit. And they tested it three or four times with the shuttle program, but they were very careful because you're untethered. And if a jet gets stuck or something goes wrong, we'll see you later. You know, it's going to be it's impossible for the shuttle to just rocket off and rescue somebody. So they did very slow, careful maneuvers. Well, in this film, he's flying it around like he's driving an Alfa Romeo, you know, going all over the place, buzzing the solar panels, which you wouldn't do because A, you might hit them, and B, the jet plumes from the backpack can be very damaging. So that was kind of goofy. So he's a real rocket jockey, and he's a little further out there in that direction than those guys are. Sandra Bullock, on the other hand, is a mission specialist. She actually would be a payload specialist in NASA's parlance, but same thing. You know, she's an astronaut that doesn't fly the spaceship. She goes up there to do things. She's repairing the Hubble Space Telescope. And she's a little too fragile and a little too delicate and a little too paranoid when the movie starts to have really been a trained astronaut for that role, because even those people that they only brought in for a couple of flights, like private astronauts or people from overseas, really trained long and hard to the point that when they did get up there, they were pretty solid. So she's a little iffier than I think anybody in that position would be.
Okay. Joining us on the show is writer, producer, and director Rod Pyle, who produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. So can we talk, I guess, about what you would think would be the biggest faux pas in the movie? Like, where did they really go out in left field?
Oh, you bet we can. I mean, I admire this movie. I respect their mission. I love the fact that they were brave enough to take a woman who's almost 50, which we don't see a lot in the movies, and put her in a role where she spends two-thirds of the movie talking to herself. That's remarkable. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen that since Castaway with Tom Hanks, you know. So that and the fact that it was about NASA and space, which is also something that isn't done much, was remarkable. So that said, and without trying to let a spoiler squeak out, there's a scene where she and Clooney are tethered together. He's almost out of gas in his rocket pack, and they're drifting at high speed from the shuttle to the space station, which that's another conversation as to how that would work. But they are, and they're coming into the space station fast. He's like, okay, grab something because we got to stop ourselves. She goes, okay. So he misses, and she misses, and he misses, and they bang around a bit. And finally, she grabs a handhold and stops. So her motion has been arrested. She's now stopped, floating in space. He continues on to the end of the rope, and then he stops and rebounds a bit, and then he's hanging there. Now, all she has to do is reach out with her pinky and reel him in, and then they go inside the space station. But there's some unknown force, a micro black hole or anti-love or something, that's yanking on George Clooney, so they get into this, I'm not going to let you go, no, leave me, save yourself kind of discussion. And I understand why the writers did it, because it gives you that moment of dramatic tension that you would have otherwise. Will he sacrifice or will he not? Mm-hmm. Will he sacrifice himself or will he not? But it can't happen because he had been stopped. So there's nothing left to pull on him, you know? There's no air, there's no gravity, there's no nothing up there. So that was one of those moments where you actually looked around the audience and saw people looking at each other like, wait a minute, that can't happen. So that was kind of a goofy thing.
So would regular people know that things were inaccurate, though? Because, like, I know you mentioned grade 5, like, science class or whatever. I don't remember grade 5 science class. So, like, if I was watching, would I be so, I guess, into the movie that I wouldn't notice some of these things? Or were they apparent, like you sort of said?
I think 90% of it was not apparent. You know, one other thing is that just if you read about this stuff, you know, the space station's at about 200 miles elevation. The Hubble was at almost 400 miles. And the satellites, which were knocked out by this debris storm, a lot of them are at 25,000 miles. So not only can the same debris storm not affect those things, but you can't be flying with a rocket pack from the shuttle or the space station to the Hubble and vice versa. So, you know, that was a big script concession, and they knew it. But it made it better because, as they pointed out, if you make a movie that's very accurate, that's nice, but it's going to take 4 hours and be really dull.
Right.
So I think, you know, this moment I'm talking about, it's one of those things where people might not know why it's wrong, but there's this kind of uncomfortable shifting in the seats of, that doesn't feel quite right. You know, like sometimes you see a bad special effect, you're not quite sure what's not right, but you kind of get this greasy feeling of, that's not really how it would look. So I think there's a little bit of that, but otherwise, no, I think they really nailed it. I mean, write down little details like, I just did an article for space.com on this experiment that these university kids did about burning flame in mm-hmm. space. Mm-hmm. And by gosh, I mean, I've been looking at movies of that for a week, you know. By gosh, they're in the space station, a panel shorts out, and there's flames drifting in zero G, and they got them absolutely right. And I just kind of sat there with my jaw hanging open, because that's something that a whole lot of directors would go, yeah, just have it spark and smoke and we'll move on to the next shot. So they really did put a lot of effort in those little things.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about this because I was listening to a radio station, one of the radio stations I work for, the other day, and they happened to have their film critic on talking about Gravity, and he had gone to see it in 3D. And he made mention that it was quite the show in 3D, especially because he is not a fan of 3D in general, but he said it really fit this movie. So if someone wants to go see this movie in 3D, like, are they going to get motion sickness? Like, it just sounds like it's like its own ride at, you know, Walt Disney World.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I hadn't thought of that part. I saw it in 3D IMAX, which is kind of the ultimate presentation, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't feel queasy at all, and I was pretty close. It wasn't like a movie like Cloverfield where the camera's moving constantly, so you're gonna get sick. And I think almost everybody that saw that at the big screen got motion sickness, and that wasn't even 3D. In this case, there's enough lockdown shots that I think for most people would be okay, but if they're susceptible to that, go see it in 2D because there is a lot of stuff flying your way. It wasn't particularly gimmicky like movies in the 50s were, where every shot something was going out in the audience.
Right.
You know, there's a bolt that flies past you and some of the debris comes at you, but it's really, instead of feeling gratuitous, it's more of a, you sort of involuntarily duck in your seat because that stuff's coming your direction. And then you think, oh, wait, it's a movie. It's okay.
Okay.
So it's handled really well.
Okay. In your opinion, again, because you've, you know, seen all kinds of space movies, is this the best one that you've seen? Or does it just that it's, you know, the 2013 version?
Yeah, I think it's definitely in the top 10. I mean, being a child of the Apollo years, very young child, but a child of the Apollo years, I loved Apollo 13. Because he nailed everything. I mean, there might be one tiny flaw in there, but Tom Hanks really cares about that stuff. We're the same age. We saw the same stuff, you know, so that's way up there. 2001 A Space Odyssey, as I saw as a kid, if you've ever seen that in a theater, the visual effects still hold up today. So that's a high watermark. There's a handful of others, but in terms of the orbital romp, this one absolutely takes the prize. And in terms of just overall space movie, it's, you know, right up there in the top 10 for sure.
And I have to ask you this. I know you're not a film critic, but I wanted to just get your take on this for just a sec, just because, you know, it's funny to talk to film critics and we have a great one on this show. She's awesome and she always sort of nails it bang on. But as someone who is not a film critic, but obviously passionate about this topic that's in the movie, do you think, because I've heard it sort of bandied about already, do you think Sandra Bullock will be nominated for a bunch of awards, including maybe an Academy? Like, did she really nail it considering she's flying around in space?
Yeah, she should be. If she doesn't, I'll understand, but she should be. I mean, we both know there's a lot of politics and other stuff involved in that. But again, you know, carrying a solo performance for 2/3 of the movie is tough. Now, there is a point in the last act where she kind of experiences this transformation from this timid woman who's scared of what's going on around her, just reacting to things, to kind of taking charge and sort of regurgitating the lines of the tough guy astronaut she's been hanging out with. That felt a little contrived and it was a bit of an eye roller, frankly, because it's like, look, lady, you were already stronger than those guys, so why are you mimicking their lines, you know? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's a tiny thing, and that's definitely an opinion, not a fact one way or the other. But I think she was remarkable and spectacular. Now, it is worth noting, as I said, I think she's 49 now. They didn't put her – normally you wear a spacesuit, and you have a complete Nomex suit under that has plastic tubes woven in it, and they pump water through there to heat one side of your body and cool the other, because in space there's a differential of about 400 degrees between the sun side and the shadow side, so you'll either freeze or bake.
Okay.
When she took off her spacesuit, it was Sigourney Weaver in the first Alien movie, you know, panties and a tank top. And even the astronauts who saw it said, you know, as a male, I was grateful they did that, but factually it's completely out to lunch. So that kind of a moment. That's a little gratuitous, but boy, you know, talk about being in top shape for being 50 years old. I wish I had looked like the male version of that, or George Clooney when I was 50 for that matter.
That's awesome. And it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you before I let you go, is there anything for space fans that should be, you know, be paying attention in the next couple of months? Like, is there anything going on that we should be really sort of paying attention to with regards to what's going on with the Russians or all that sort of stuff?
What we should be waiting for is for NASA to reopen their doors. It's very interesting. The agency laid off or furloughed 97% of their personnel. JPL, however, did not have to shut down the Mars rover because they're run by Caltech, who gets their money from NASA. So Caltech said, no, we're keeping the place open. So there's some results coming up from the latest drill sample analysis off of Curiosity that are said through back channels to be nothing short of remarkable. So I think that's something to look forward to, because when somebody says remarkable and you're talking about samples on Mars, I'm not predicting this, but that could mean organics, and that's something that we're all really hoping for.
Okay, perfect. Rod, thank you as always. It's always fascinating to talk to you. Thanks so much.
You bet. Take care.
That's Rod Pyle, writer, producer, and director. And again, he wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
The 80-20 rule of results and causes is completely in effect when it comes to the music business. Sales of albums over the last couple of years are way more shocking than you might think. To explain all this, our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, good. So I'm actually interested to get your take on this. What does the 80-20 rule mean to people in the business or the music industry these days?
Well, the first of all, like the sort of, it's a common rule of thumb, right? Like the whole thing of 80% of your sales come from 20% of your clients, right? Mm-hmm. So like for the music business, it's like 80% of the money comes from like 20% of the artists that they have signed. But now they're saying that that is more like the 85 rule.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. So I saw this stat over the weekend and I thought, like, we got to talk about this because 98.9% of all digital music tracks in existence in 2011
mm-hmm.
have sold fewer than 1,000 copies.
What?
Like, most songs uh-huh. have sold less than 1,000 copies. Well, you do remember, like, last summer, Rihanna had a single out, and it set a record for being the lowest-selling number one in UK chart history. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. Which one was it?
Yeah, I don't remember what track it was, but it sold, like, 9,000 copies.
Really?
And that made it number one, because people, like, just don't buy singles.
I thought that was what everybody was doing. I thought no one was buying albums, they were buying singles.
Well, here's the thing. You know, this is what we always talk about. With if you're like, especially a pop artist, like somebody like Rihanna who appeals to like a younger demo, most of your fans just are content to watch your videos on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. So as far as like selling physical copies or even selling downloads, you'd be amazed at like some of the more popular artists, how few they actually sell.
I am shocked because I thought that's what everybody was doing. I thought like it was like we talked about, I think a couple of weeks back about, you know, Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines. I figured like, everyone's buying that single and his album might not do well.
They downloaded a lot of singles, but I mean, it's still like there's very few Blurred Lines, right? I mean, that was like the song of the summer. Uh-huh. If you look at Blurred Lines and you look at Daft Punk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two biggest records of this year, I would say, as far as songs go, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think those are going to be the only really top sellers. And even if you say 10 more, it's still not very many. How many songs are out? There's millions.
Wow. I'm really, yeah, so I'm shocked. So like you said, everyone is, but then when you go to YouTube and you see everyone that's got like 2 billion views, people are just watching it.
That's where they all go.
Oh my God.
And that's why they had to adjust the Billboard charts because, yeah, I mean, they got to count that, right? If somebody watches your video 100 million times and only buys like 100 of your singles, I mean, you got to talk about the YouTube views, right?
Wow. This is such a like a huge shift in the last, like, I wouldn't even say 2 years. It's got to be like a year, maybe less.
Yeah, yeah. It's getting worse and worse all the time. In the news now is that YouTube is going to launch a subscription service, but I don't know how that's going to work out for them.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. I'm so in shock because I just thought everybody was buying the single, like buying it. Because my question is then, if they're not buying the single, because like, what about these people like go to the gym? Like, you know, like I've got all my music and then I sort of make my little music playlist and then I take it in my MP3 player to the gym. So is no one taking music with them anywhere?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, you can even make, there's a whole bunch of iPhone apps where you can make a playlist, an audio playlist out of YouTube tracks.
Wow.
And I think it's really a YouTube world right now. And I think that if you were going to do that, I think a lot of people would just, you know, make a playlist from there. Because when you tell somebody about a song,
uh-huh.
they're most likely to just go look it up on YouTube. They're not going to go and see what album it's from.
Right.
They're not going to go to a store. They're not even going to open up iTunes because it opens up slower than YouTube opens.
Right.
So they're just going to go to YouTube and just like, oh, yeah, that song. Cool. Okay. So, you know, the easier people make it for you to just like, you know, stream music from YouTube, then the less people going to buy anything. I mean, iTunes was easy when it came out. It was like, oh my God, you can download a song and it's right there in your computer.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, I gotta wait like 40 seconds for a download.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Wow, that's crazy. I guess it's sort of interesting to take yourself out of, I guess, like the norm, quote unquote, because of what I do and what you do, like, I think you and I operate differently than normal people would, I guess. Like, I would go still get the music or go still. I mean, I do have to say, though, if someone tells me, hey, check out this, I do go to YouTube first to check it out.
Right.
And then go forward with, oh, I should get it, or, oh, okay, now I understand what's going on. But wow, that's really interesting.
So it's pretty crazy.
So who's actually benefiting then from the sales of what's going on? Is it the old artists, or actually, it doesn't sound like it's new artists.
Yeah, well, I think the new artists are the ones who are getting the least sales, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should say the smallest percentage of the sales. I think some of the older artists are probably doing better with the physical sales when their albums come out. Like, I mean, Paul McCartney's album, I don't know where it's going to wind up on the chart, but I mean, I would assume that the people who are going to get his album will either download it through iTunes or actually, you know, order a CD from Amazon or something. But I would think that somebody like Paul McCartney or Bruce Springsteen would sell probably more physical copies than somebody like Rihanna or Justin Bieber.
Wow. And then where are they making up the difference? Is it on their YouTube channels? Like, how does this work?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of YouTube partnership stuff going on. Those sort of pre-roll ads before the, you know, the commercial, before the commercial, as people like to call them.
I hate those.
So yeah, so the pre-roll ads are a big thing, because I mean, obviously you can sell those. So I think a lot of artists are getting into that, because when you do look something up on YouTube, that is the first thing you see, is like a commercial for like a Chrysler Sebring or something. Wow. You know, just get the song, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I think that a lot of money's being made there. And of course, you know, the old story that, you know, you got a tour, you got to get out there, you got to sell merchandise, you know, groups like One Direction, I mean, they probably sell more merchandise than the Beatles sold records. And of course, the merchandise, they have everything possible that they can manufacture, they manufacture, so you can run out there and buy it.
Yeah, I should get myself one of those One Direction lunch pails. That's what I really should. So in your estimation, then, how big of a change is this for the industry? Because it hasn't always been this way, I don't think.
No, this is what's funny. Like, it hasn't always been this way, I don't think, but for a couple of reasons. First of all, because there were never as many releases as there are right now.
Okay.
I mean, there's so much music out. There's so much choice. You know, because it's much easier to record something now. I mean, you can record something in your house, right, on a laptop. Mm-hmm. So there's so much more music being released. But I kind of think that it was similar back in the day, because, you know, everybody, you know, we talk about the Beatles, right? And it's mm-hmm. like, well, how many groups were selling anywhere near what the Beatles were selling? You know, not many.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a couple of people that were, I mean, there was, you know, Dave Clark Five, or, you know, the Stones, all these different groups. You know, the Stones and the Beatles are at one level, and I think everybody else was like, you know, a very distant second or third. So it's interesting to note, I mean, I don't really know what the percentage was, you know, in the 60s and 70s, but really, I mean, when Michael Jackson's Thriller was the biggest album, what was the second biggest album? I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, me neither. Nope.
I mean, who cares, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the second album was everything else.
Yeah, that's right. Wow. But okay, a question for you then, like up and coming artists that don't even have the clout that, let's say, I'm just trying to think of someone like Cody Simpson or what's his name? Austin Mahoney, whatever, however you say his name. He's sort of like the new Bieber, right? So
right.
These guys are sort of rising through the ranks right now. But like, let's say you look at someone who's a little bit less than that, like a Sky Stevens or something, like in the pop world. Like, how are they going to make their money? Is it going to be them gigging? Like, is that where? Because I don't know how many, let's say, T-shirts Sky Stevens is going to sell.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I really think right now that those sort of artists especially, I think that's what they're moving towards. Because you look at, you know, One Direction. I read an article over the weekend, actually. It was an old article, but it was talking about how One Direction has become the biggest group in the world that you've never heard of.
Right.
Because the way things are compartmentalized now, I mean, you don't have to hear stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you like someone or don't like someone, you can either listen to them all the time or not listen to them all the time. It's very easy now. In the old days, it was like, every time I turn on the radio, I got to hear that whatever song, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember when Thriller was big and you'd walk into a store and it would be playing, you'd go to somebody's house, it would be playing, you put on the radio, it was on every station. Mm-hmm. Those days are gone. Now mm-hmm. people can really listen to what they want to listen to.
Okay.
And One Direction, I mean, they built up most of their fan base online, more than, you know, getting airplay, because I can't name two songs.
Yeah,
no. You know what I mean? It's like, so they've done this thing where it's like the only tangible thing that people really want from them, I think, is the merch, because they don't hear them on the radio. They see them online. The kids listen to them on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And they, you know, they read about them. They follow them on Twitter and Facebook and that sort of thing. But, you know, they can go to a concert and they can buy a shirt, or they can go and buy the One Direction perfume, or they can buy, you know, I see all kinds of merch everywhere, even though I don't hear the music anywhere.
Right.
So I think that a lot of new pop acts, what they have to do is build up sort of a, you have to build up like a presence where people are going to want to own something that has your name on it, that you can sell them, more importantly.
Wow.
I think that's what everybody's going to try to do now. So all of the sort of new Biebers who are coming up, that's what they're aiming for. They're trying to get themselves you know, they're trying to make a connection with their fans online so that their fans have an emotional connection to the merchandise they may buy.
Wow.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
But it's true.
That's nutty. Wow, that's crazy. Well, I always appreciate you getting us up to speed because I'm really like tongue-tied and flabbergasted. I thought everyone was buying singles. Like I thought everyone was like, oh, here's a single, there's a single. Like, and you can download it, like you said, in 40 seconds, but apparently that's too long nowadays.
That's too long.
Wow, Patrick, thank you so much for this.
Anytime.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. You can learn more about him on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Also, make sure to follow him on Twitter, @GetPatrick.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Many of us have either been affected by or know someone affected by breast cancer. Today, you're going to hear the story of Linda and Bob Carey, who after Linda's cancer diagnosis, created a project that is truly beautiful and inspiring. Linda and Bob, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Hi,
Kelly. Hi. So here's the thing. Can you tell me how the Tutu Project actually came about?
Well, it stemmed from a project that I had been doing for 10 years, and I've been photographing myself for 20 years. And after the first 10-year project, I started photographing myself in a tutu. And the whole idea of photographing myself is to transform myself into something I'm not. And I'm definitely not a ballerina. And it's basically just to investigate myself as something I'm not. And for the viewer and for the people that see me do this, they ask questions, you know, why is he wearing a pink tutu or why is he wearing a piece of pink material? And so actually, I start doing this project 8 months before Linda was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was just kind of an experiment with my imagery. And then when she was diagnosed, I start doing it more just to kind of get out of the house, get out of the environment of the recovery, and just to kind of take care of myself. Because when I photograph myself, it's like my own self-therapy. So after she was diagnosed, I continued to do it more. 3 years later, her cancer metastasized, and then she had to go back to the cancer center and get treatments again. And she started to show my images to the women there that were receiving treatment, and it made them happy. And so we decided to start a project and to publish a book that would bring all the images together, and we could place books into cancer centers around the country. Use the net proceeds to help women with things they need during treatment, such as childcare, acupuncture, things just to make them feel better because it's not a very fun time. And there isn't a lot of organizations that do things like that. It's more about research and a cure, and we just want to help people one-on-one.
That is fantastic. And if I backtrack the two of you for just a sec, Linda, can you give us a little bit of an idea about, you know, how you came about your diagnosis back in 2003 and then, you know, what it felt like to have to deal with it again in 2006?
Well, as Bob mentioned, we had just moved to Brooklyn, and so it was fairly scary as just to find a lump. We had just gotten our health insurance out here, which I was very grateful for. Found the lump, had to find a doctor because we didn't know anyone really. Was diagnosed a few days after Christmas, and it was just scary. That's all. Any woman or any person that has to hear you have cancer is stops your heart for a moment. But I found great doctors. We found some good support out here. Went through all the treatments, surgery, radiation, and chemo. And then there's this sort of feeling of elation once you get through that. It's like, wow, I made it through 18 months of some grueling treatment. And you start living your life again, or at least I did. And then to have it come back 18 months later, I mean, I remember the moment my nurse called me and told me my test results. And I was the one that had actually called my doctor and said, you know, I don't feel sick, but something just seems off, and I don't think we should wait 2 months to do more testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she called to tell me that it had spread, I mean, I suppose part of me knew that, but it was still, I mean, it was, to say that it was devastating to hear that news, maybe that is a new, that's not even a good word. It was very frightening. But once again, I have a really great support system. You know, my doctors, Bob, my family, and I have some really great friends. So not to make light of it, but they really helped me through those first couple of years.
Can I ask you, because my mom is actually a breast cancer survivor. She was diagnosed in 2009, which was like a huge shock for us because we have no one in the family that has ever had breast cancer. Like, it really was someone else's disease, if you will. And so it was very shocking, obviously. But I remember how my mom sort of dealt with the news initially. And I'm just wondering, like, how you felt. Like, I know it's sort of, I guess, you know, you're in shock when you get the news, but how did you sort of feel, like, the 2, 3, 4 days, like, after? Like, when did it start to sink in, like, we have to, you know, go to battle?
What came to mind right now is when Bob, my sister, and I were sitting in my surgeon's office, and she, you know, we're talking about the specifics, and I don't know, it was just like, okay, so this is something I have to do. It's freaking me out. But how, you know, what is all this? First, what does all this language mean? And then what do we need to do? And what happens after that? And I don't know, just wrapping my head around, I'm a fairly feisty woman.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob and I work together, and I'm a producer for our advertising photography business. So this is what I did literally. My mind is like, okay, so what next? I got out a notebook that I used, like a black notebook I used to produce projects, and I really started it as if it was a job. And it's like, okay, well, this is how I know how to handle things, and this is how I'm going to do it moving forward.
And did you ever feel like, especially when the cancer was still sort of in you, like, did you freak out? Like, did you just want it out? Did you feel like your body had betrayed you? Like, I'm always interested to feel how people feel when something like that, well, obviously it's usually cancer that is that sort of way, but did you feel like it had invaded you?
No, I didn't ever feel that way. It's really weird. It was, it's like, okay, this happened. It's cancer, and it's something I had to deal with. I don't feel like my body betrayed me at all. It's just something that happened. My family, as with your mother, we had no history of it. So we have other cancers, but never breast cancer, nothing that was related. It just happens. And I wasn't going to... I actually embraced my body at that time and said, okay, body, we need to get you as strong as possible. You're heading into some pretty rough treatments, and let's see how strong we can get you before. I mean, I had these kind of, it might sound strange, but I'd have these conversations with my body, and I don't know, it kind of proved to be a pretty good team.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting way to look at it. I think that's great. And when you were sort of, you know, needing to go through this and stuff, I know you said that your family and friends were quite supportive. Did you initially sort of embrace their support, or did you need a little bit of alone time to come to terms? Because I know my mom, she was very grateful for our support, but I know she sort of had to take her time to sort of come to terms with it.
I would say it was both. I mean, there were times when I needed to talk to people, and there were times that I just really needed to head out. Well, for example, the weekend before I had my surgery, Bob and I had just moved out here, so we moved from Phoenix. We had a lot of support in Phoenix, and people were all calling me, and it was probably about 6 hours of being on the phone. I finally looked at Bob and said, I can't talk anymore. It's so wonderful to be talking and getting all this love through the phone, but I need to go out. And so I just headed out for a walk. And that's sort of how I dealt with it, is, okay, when it became too much, I just put my tennis shoes on and went for a walk. Just sort of, I don't know if it was making peace within my mind, because I really wasn't to that point of making peace, but I really needed some downtime.
Mm-hmm. And how important would you say, like, I know you said you had conversations with yourself, you know, and you're sort of talking to your body. I think, like, I've done that before when I went through a bit of a health crisis and it wasn't even cancer. So I understand where you're coming from. Do you feel that your positive attitude and, like, just the way you approached it helped you get through it maybe as well as you did?
Absolutely. I think the strength of my mind and how I chose to look at it, I think that absolutely helped my healing. And even though it came back,
mm-hmm.
I think it was, with my case, and I had a very aggressive form of cancer, I think it probably was already spread at the time of my surgery. So, but absolutely, positive frame of mind has helped me in these last 10 years.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Bob and Linda Carey, creators behind the Tutu Project. For more information, make sure to check out their website, thetutuproject.com. I want to move back to the project right now. How, or do you, like, where does the inspiration come from for some of these photos?
Well, the inspiration would be what's happening at the time, you know, like, depending on how I'm feeling, I could jump or I could do something fun, or lately I know I've gained some weight, so I just take pictures from the back. I don't show the front. So it's like, it's a personal thing for me, and it's a bit emotional, but I'll shoot something from the front if I'm like hanging off of something because my body stretches out and it looks better, but I don't know as far as, conceptualizing. I think the concept is pretty much the same in each image. I kind of go with the landscape because a lot of them are different.
And I wanted to ask you, you sort of mentioned before, Bob, that there was a positive response from the patients that Linda was showing these pictures to. So were they just enjoying all of them, or does each person sort of respond differently? And do you think it's a way to get out of their situation in the fact that they are dealing with a health crisis?
Well, I think that, each image has its own response. And the way, some people think that it's, looking at these pictures is a great way to spend time away from reality when they're being pumped full of poison,
mm-hmm.
And they can see so many things in them, and, everybody responds differently, like I said, but, there's there's joy, there's loneliness, there's melancholy, there's, every emotion in them, and a lot of people like to fantasize that they can do the same, that they can do something that I would do, which a lot of people won't do.
Right.
Which is to be very vulnerable and not care about what other people think, and I do care about what other people think, but when I'm doing it, the only thing I pay attention to is physically dying. Like mm-hmm. if I'm going to get hit by a car, or if some crazy person's coming at me with something, or, I don't care about responses if it's a negative response, unless I'm in harm's way, but otherwise all the comments and everything, and I hardly ever have any negative comments. So, but if I hear anything, I just go tunnel vision in my hearing and kind of in my sight, and I just make sure I get the shot without dying,
Right. And I wanted to ask you, I guess, two questions, Bob. First of all, where do you see the project going? Like, do you have sort of long-term plans again? And also, I did want to take you back to Linda's situation for just a second, because we don't often get to hear from a woman's partner when it comes to dealing with breast cancer. I know my dad was sort of fairly tight-lipped throughout the whole thing. Like, he's sort of like that anyways, but he was very supportive, but I guess we didn't really see maybe how vulnerable he was. Maybe he sort of just shared that with my mother in their alone time. But, like, what was it like for you to have to see Linda go through this and also to be her support system? But probably you were scared as well, obviously.
Well, at the time when she was diagnosed, I'd seen probably three people in my life that had died of breast cancer, my mom being one of them, my godmother, and then my mom's best friend. And so when I heard, that Linda was diagnosed, and I was on a plane when she was, and when I landed, she told me to ask me if I could take a cab home. I knew for sure something's wrong. And so I go into the mode of denying this stuff because I know what I've seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've seen a lot more. My family has, and Linda's family. So I deny it until we need to take action. If something else happens, then we go into action. But for me, it's taking care of what needs to be taken care of at the time. And Linda deals with every day that she knows that it could come back. And I just want to know when it does so we can do the next thing.
Right.
Because I hate going that other place. And
yeah.
But because I know so well, what could happen, and so does she. So, I worry. you know, it could be devastating. And I know, I already know that. So I try not to stay in that place.
Okay. And again, where do you want to take the 2-2 project as you move forward?
Well, that's kind of a good question. I mean, I'm working on a whole new series of imagery, and what they're about is, since this whole project has taken off all over the world, I've been able to get into places and photograph things that I never could before, you know, like with the American Ballet Theater with Swan Lake at Lincoln Center, and, you know, with the New York Giants at a pregame show with the New York Giants, the Arizona Cardinals. I'm, you know, Big Apple Circus. So that could be the next thing. But I think the next thing that could be is, I don't know, it could be, it'll probably still be self-portraits, and it'll probably be about transforming myself, and probably won't have anything to do with the tutu.
Okay.
And it could be called the Tutu Project still, but it may be, I could be doing something else, you know?
Right.
It'll be very minimal, and it'll be very, and everything I do is, I'm very anti-quirky, and, I mean, it's funny, but it's never to be cute, really. You know?
Right.
It's to be introspective, yet have a little twist on something, which I don't really know what it is, but...
That's fine. Guys, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is Bob and Linda Carey, again, the creators of the Tutu Project. For more information and check out their photos, you can do that on their website, thetutuproject.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Vancouver-based singer-songwriter Lydia Hall. Lydia, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much, Kelly.
So I wanted to start off by asking you about how you got into music, and has it always been the objective to have like a music career, or did you sort of just follow along that path?
I've always been loved singing and music, and it really felt more of like something that evolved over time. When I was in university, I was kind of thinking of being a music therapist or something like that. But then I just started, you know, doing open mics and playing shows, and eventually now I've kind of found myself fully engaged in being an artist. So, yeah, definitely felt something that's been quite a natural process.
Is it hard for you to be artist/businesswoman? Because I've done some singing, and I know that the promotion part of it is just as equally as important as what you're creating. So is it hard to switch hats, or do you find it's something that you just know you need to do?
That's actually a really interesting question, because I definitely came into it purely from the art side, and it's probably just been the last maybe year and a half that I've really started to realize how much of, you know, creating a small business it is for yourself. So I actually do find that them two very different, but also both really challenging hats to put on. But yeah, I do find them as kind of two separate things, but both really fun for me to do, I think. I'm really enjoying both aspects of it.
Oh, that's great, because I know just for this show, you know, I have to do promotion for that, and most of me would just like to be the person that creates my show and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes being businesswoman annoys me, so it's good to hear that you you embrace it, I guess.
I think it's definitely been like a journey to embrace it, perhaps. I think it's definitely something you just have to keep a balance of, right?
Yeah.
Cool. But I know a lot of my friends are like, what do you do all day? What do you do? Like, you can't just play guitar all day. And I'm like, wait, I'll tell you what I do all day. It's great, yeah.
That's awesome. Now, I read that you are a multi-instrumentalist, so can you tell us what instruments you actually play?
Yeah, when I do my live show, I play guitar and mandolin, and then I play the Irish drum, which is the boron. And then depending on who I'm playing with, if I'm doing a solo show, I'll have a suitcase kick drum that I use as well, which is kind of fun.
That's awesome. And do you find that you identify the most with the guitar, or is there another instrument in that list that calls out to you more?
Yeah, actually, the mandolin is just absolutely my favorite instrument. The first time I saw someone playing it, I was like, what is that? I have to learn how to play it. It's just such a really bright sound, and it's really small, so you can kind of dance around with it on stage. And it just, yeah, it's a really lovely little, it has a lot of space to it, which I really like, so the guitar sustains a lot more. Mm-hmm. For the mandolin, you can kind of just punctuate and be more rhythmic with it. So that one's my favorite for sure.
And do you find that instrument plays a significant part in your sound?
Definitely, yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all my songs, I try to incorporate a little bit of mandolin into it. And yeah, I like it a lot.
Do you think that sets you apart from other artists? Because, I mean, as you and I both know, there's such a community of singer-songwriters, whether you're in Vancouver or Toronto or Montreal. Do you find that having that mandolin sound sets you a little bit apart from other people?
Actually, I think it does. Like, after shows, I'll often kind of have two reactions. Either some will come and be like, what is that? I loved it. I've never seen that before. Or I'll have, like, other musicians come up and be like, sweet mandolin, I loved it. Like, people just tend to really appreciate it. And I like to switch, like, I'll try to do intersperse my mandolin songs within my guitar songs. So it just adds a little tone and stands out.
Okay. I want you to talk to us a little bit about the community that you're in Vancouver, because I've had the pleasure of interviewing a bunch of groups from out there, including Hey Ocean and Head of the Herd, which I know that you're affiliated with. Yes. And I'm sure you've done some shows across the country. So what's so special about Vancouver, and do you really find it's got its own sort of thing going on?
Yeah, I mean, I've played across the country, and Vancouver, it's definitely laid back, which is really nice. It's definitely a very small music city. Everyone kind of knows everyone else. Yeah, I think it's just like, it's an easy place to feel relaxed and able to do music. And I've talked to other people about it, but the rain is actually quite helpful because, you know, 6 months a year, you really have to be inside for a lot of it. So it's a good place to do songwriting for sure. I'm also involved in the Peak Performance Project right now, which is a kind of really great Vancouver music community builder. And they take 20 bands in the province and do an artist development program with them for about 6 months. So I'm doing that right now, which is great. So I've met a lot of other amazing bands. I'm actually on the road right now with another Peak Performance band who are playing a couple shows with me.
As you mentioned, you've played across the country, and I know Vancouver is home, but is there another place that sort of calls out to you or has a special place in your heart for whatever reason?
Yes, definitely. yeah, I did a tour to the Maritimes in the springtime, and that just like... I kind of had this calling that I really wanted to head out there. So I went out on like a 6-week tour by myself out there, and I stayed in Prince Edward Island for quite a bit longer than I planned and just really fell in love with the people there. And I'm kind of scheming right now how to get back there. That's the reasoning is. But yeah, I also really love Toronto as well. It's one of my other favorite places to go. So I'll try to get back there soon as well.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Vancouver-based singer-songwriter Lydia Hall. Make sure to check her out on her website, lydiahall.com, and that is H-O-L. I wanted to ask you, I'm sort of having geography questions, I guess, come up here. Do you ever feel the need or a calling to go south of the border? Like, do you ever think you'll be based out of, let's say, Los Angeles? Because I know a lot of Vancouverites often head down there.
It's definitely on my kind of next year of list of things to do would probably be to hit up Los Angeles and Nashville as well. Still haven't quite made the crossover there. It seems a little bit more intimidating, I think, to go outside of Canada, but I'm definitely something I'm going to do this next upcoming year.
Talk to us about your new single, This Fire. What's it about, and what do you want people to sort of pull from it?
Yeah, I recorded This Fire in August of this year with Howard Ruddicott, who's an amazing producer from Vancouver. He's done Tegan and Sarah and Hannah George's and Mother Mother. So it's a pretty cool opportunity to work with him. And the kind of vibe of the song that we went for was like 1971 Neil Young, kind of like really driving rhythm. And yeah, we just had a blast recording it. And then I made this big music video to go along with it where I'm sitting up in a tree about 10 feet in the air. And I had to sit up in that tree for like 3 hours. So, and it's all lit up with lanterns and candles and stuff. So it's pretty neat. But yeah, it's just a kind of song about having a fire burning within you. In kind of a couple different ways towards the relationship, but also towards the path of being a musician, kind of keep that fire burning.
I wanted to ask you as well, when it comes to what you do and how you do it, is there another artist or a band that you look to for inspiration or that you feel you're connected to? Like, I know you mentioned Tegan and Sarah. Are they an inspiration at all? Or
yeah, absolutely. I do find myself kind of looking towards other female artists for sure. There is like... In my experience, at least in Vancouver and kind of my musicians, I know that it is definitely a male-dominated industry. So I definitely try to kind of seek out other females in the business. So, yeah, a lot of the East Coast singer-songwriters I like too, like Jen Grant and Rose Cousins and Mila Kiran. And then kind of looking more broader, like Anise Mitchell and Laura Marling would all be kind of influences for me. And then Feist as well is probably my biggest Canadian one that I'm pretty into.
I wanted to ask you, I interviewed Ladies of the Canyon recently, and I asked them about Serena Ryder. They're obviously friends with her.
Well, and I love Serena Ryder.
So I wanted to ask you, especially because, you know, she's had an incredible year, and mm-hmm. you know, everybody wanted a piece of her, including all of the media. And I, you know, I was fortunate to be able to speak to her as well. What do you feel about the way her career has gone? Like, is that something that you would, I don't want to use the word emulate, but is it something to watch to sort of say, hey, I like how she's put it together?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she has such a great sound, and it has really been like a slowly evolving, hardworking career that looks like it's really paying off now. So no, she's absolutely someone to look up to. I saw her play at a music festival last summer, and it was just amazing. It was great.
I wanted to ask you about your, I guess, long-term plans. Are you working on an album now? And if so, when can we expect to see it drop?
Yeah, I'm just kind of wrapping up with this artist development part of what I was mentioning. And then I'm going to be starting to do some writing and some co-writing, and then starting recording probably early January. Probably going to be an EP coming out in the late springtime.
Okay. And we have a lot of listeners right now that are listening from overseas in Australia and Japan. And other such places like that. You know, and again, on my show, I have been fortunate to interview some songwriters. Can you explain to them, though, a little bit about what your days are like? I know we sort of briefly touched on that at the top, but I think a lot of people wonder how you actually survive.
How you survive?
Yeah.
Barely. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, like, for example, my day yesterday, I had, like, rehearsals in the morning, and then in the afternoon I had a meeting with a grant writer to help me write some grants, and then I did postering all afternoon, walking around the city.
Yep.
And then kind of the evening, I was on my computer for a few hours just looking at social media, updating my website, and reaching out to the media and things like that for an upcoming show I'm doing. So yeah, it's kind of, and then today I left to come up to do a show in the interior of BC. So it's kind of like, yeah, each day looks really different. And I think that's why it's easy to be sustainable, because you always have something new coming up. Mm-hmm. And there's always something cool going on. And then when you do have a little bit of time off, you can be writing and recording, things like that. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And I guess the final question would be, where do you see yourself in the next, 18 months or so?
Yeah, definitely heading across Canada again, for sure. So I'll have a new recording out. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a break from doing shows, just because I've been playing a lot. So to do some writing and recording, and then I'll be definitely, heading across Canada again for sure, Montreal, Toronto, and the East Coast. I still haven't delved into the Prairie Drive yet, so I'll try to skip that as many times as I can. But hopefully heading down to the States a little bit as well.
That's fantastic. Lydia, I want to thank you so much for hanging out, and we're happy to have you on the show anytime.
Great. Thanks so much, Kelly. It was awesome chatting to you.
This is Lydia Hall. Make sure to follow her on her website for all the social media, lydiahall.com.
A fire's been burning since the day that we met. Though the wind's been yearning, hasn't blown it out yet. A fire's been burning since the day that you left. Though you've since apologized to me, I can't blow it out. Yeah.
big thank you going out to my guests this week, Rod Pyle, Patrick Charles, Bob and Linda Carey, as well as Lydia Hall. As per usual, leaving you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Steve Goodyear. We are stronger than we think. We have emotional, spiritual, and even physical resources at our disposal. We may get knocked down, but we must not stay down. Thank you so much for hanging out. We always appreciate your time. Don't forget to reach out to us on social media at K Alexander Show, also our Facebook page, Kelly Alexander Show. And again, make sure to check out all of our interviews on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.